You're listening to another great podcast in the Stoplight Network.
Hi, folks, and welcome to episode 4 of the Let's Talk Apple podcast, the theoretically December edition of the show, as in December 2013. It's not that I recorded this in December and forgot to publish it until into early January. It's that I just had an interesting December, as in the may you live in interesting times kind of interesting December. So we're recording in early January, and we're just going to look at the news up to the end of the year, and then we'll be back at the end of this month, hopefully punctually, for a new show. Anyway, I'm your host, Bart Bouchotz, and joining me we have a fantastic panel with two voices you will know and one guest substitution for a voice you will know. So first off, we have Alistair Jenks with us again. Alistair is time-travelling to us from tomorrow because he's in New Zealand, so good morning.
I'm used to that now, Bart.
Yeah, because it's
very rare
here
that I podcast on my own time zone.
Yeah, well, I'm sitting here in the dark, well, in the light of a Christmas tree because it's night and it's morning for you. That's weird.
Yeah, it's probably not much lighter here. We're not having much of a summer yet.
Oh, of course, it's even summer for you. It's completely different. I'm sitting here in a gloomy winter. Anyway, welcome aboard. We'll do detailed plugging at the end, but do you want to do one quick plug of something at the start?
Yeah, find me on Twitter at ZKARJ.
Or ZKARJ. I can't remember. I'm so confused now. I don't even know which one's European and which one's American anymore. Guy, help.
Well, basically, if you say Z, it's the American part of it. And if you say Z, though, of course, I have to say Gaz has got me saying Z like all the time now. You know, even when I'm at work, they'll say, well, how does that go? I said, well, it's 3-2-1-Z-Z-3. And they're like, what? Z?
Oh, dear. Well, as people can probably guess, our guest substitution is Guy Searle from from the My Mac podcast.
We inflict that podcast on everyone on a weekly basis. Thank you.
And Guy's partner in crime is Gaz, who listeners to this show will know. And Gaz had to nip out for family engagement, and Guy very kindly jumped in pretty much last minute. So thank you very much, Guy.
I'm just a wonderful person. And may I say, that while Alistair may be in tomorrow, I'm still dealing with last week.
Oh, dear. You are on the other side of the... Well, the other side of me, anyway. You're way over there in the United States of America. A little bit closer to me, although there is still water between us. Nick Riley joins us again. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Bart.
And as people can probably tell by Nick's accent, Nick would be in the United Kingdom.
Indeed. And if you listen very carefully to my accent, you can tell that I live in the Birmingham area.
Do you know, I wouldn't have guessed that, but I'm awful at accents. So we are being quite global today, from New Zealand all the way to America and two little islands in between. Now, as I said to the panel earlier, I had sort of expected the December show to be a quiet one. You know, we'll a few news stories. I'll end up looking for, you know, silly little nuggets to fill out the hour. And it'll just be a nice, easy one over the holidays. And it turns out someone decided that there should be lots of news on a December. So we actually have... Yeah, I know. We've quite a full show. So before we get into new stuff, just a few follow-ups from the previous show, if you can remember back that far. We had said that the Supreme Court of the United States might be taking up a case which could potentially have major impact on patents. Well, they have taken up the case, so it still could have major impact. They haven't ruled, but they have taken it up. And what's at issue is the definition of abstract, which sounds quite abstract.
It's like redundancy.
Yeah.
You can look that up under redundancy.
Something like that. So US patent law says that you can't patent an abstract concept. But no one seems to know what that is. And there's very much conflicting rulings from the lower courts. So the Supreme Court have taken up the case and are very likely to end up defining that term in some sort of legal sense. And it will have major effects on patent law one way or the other. Whichever way they find it will be important, although obviously I hope they find that it's harder to patent things.
Yes.
Supreme Court looking for the definition of undefinable.
I know. Wasn't it a Supreme Court judge who said that I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it?
Quite possibly.
Pretty sure that was...
I may have said that at one point myself.
I think a lot of people do. I'm convinced it was a US Supreme Court judge who came out with that wonderful little gem. We also talked last month about the Rockstar Consortium, which is Apple and a bunch of other tech companies who bought Nortel's patents. And they sat on them for a while, and then last month, or I should have said in November, they unleashed dogs of war, or whatever that phrase is, and they sued a whole bunch of people about those patents, including Google, and they're not happy. So they have asked the court, could they please stop Apple being so mean with the patents?
Aww.
I think Florian Mueller from Foss Patents probably summed it up the best. Hypocrisy, thy name is Google. This is very much a game they play too, and it seems a bit silly that they go running to Mammy when someone else plays their game against them. So, am I being too harsh?
No.
Especially when Mammy invited them over for a hug earlier on.
That's true. They're now claiming these patents are of no relevance, but they bid $3 billion for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can have your cake and eat it, but you can't... You know, yeah, anyway.
Well, it's nice to have $3 billion in pocket change.
True, true. Nick?
It does seem to be that it's basically, you've abused our patents. No, we haven't. Well, maybe we have, but you've abused our patents as well.
It's
like two kids arguing, really, isn't it, in the playground?
It's like a Monty Python sketch, in my view. That's not an argument. Yes, it is.
I came here for abuse. Oh, that's next door.
Stupid git.
Ah, the joys of Python.
I love Python.
So that's sort of our catch-up stuff. So then we get to get stuck into the December news. And I've condensed this into one story for the point of view of logic. So I'm just going to tell a little story and then we can have a discussion later. So where we left our story, a judge had ruled that Apple had violated antitrust law and had appointed someone to oversee Apple's changes in line with that. This is, of course, the eBooks case. So Michael Bromwich was appointed, and he was to be Apple's overseer, and he started work, and he sent Apple a bill for his first 2 weeks on the job, and that bill came to $138,432, which is an hourly rate of $1,100, which is not bad going. Apple didn't feel this was entirely fair, And they also felt that he was being a little unreasonable in how he did his job. He basically wanted to talk to absolutely everyone in the company, including people who have nothing whatsoever to do with ebooks. And he said something which implied to Apple that he had had so-called ex parte meetings with Judge Coate, i.e. him and her had had a meeting that Apple weren't at. So, you know, ex parte, secret meeting, same sort of thing. And they were cranky and filed some paperwork with the court. Judge Coate got the paperwork and basically said, I don't care. If you have a problem, go talk to the DOJ. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no ex parte meetings, and I promise not to do it again.
All right, so she didn't do it, but she won't do it again.
Well, maybe slightly ad-libbing there. She says no such thing happened, but he said she told him to hit the ground running. So when did she tell him to hit the ground running if they didn't talk? Which, anyway, that's... I guess we might be arguing about the meaning of meeting, to go with the meaning of abstract, I guess.
I think this guy is just a bully, frankly, and he'll make things up to suit his own story.
It's hard to know whether he's just very keen on oversight. It's hard to know what to make of him, but he certainly...
I think he's very keen on getting $1,100 an hour.
I would be too, I guess.
I would bet that if you went back 2, 3, 4, 5 years in his life, he was never had an Apple product, and he's one of those ones who's always been outspoken against the walled garden and blah, blah, blah. I think he's got something in his head against Apple, which is completely the wrong state of mind to be an impartial monitor.
I think my biggest problem is that he's best mates with the judge. Or at least good friends from what the media report. I mean, best mates is arguable, but they certainly seem to be on friendly terms, which is odd.
He never should have been appointed just based on that prior relationship.
That's how I would think about it. I can understand how Apple feel a bit hard done by, because the judge appoints her friend to look over them, who then gets to set his own fee, which he won't adjudicate on, and it does seem to be a rather high fee. And his answer is basically, you don't get to decide my fee, I get to decide my fee, I think my fee's perfectly fair, it's your job to pay it. Which, yeah, okay, that's a bit harsh. So he actually responded to Apple by also filing a motion with the court, complaining that Apple were being obstructionist. And Apple have filed another piece of paperwork with the court, asking that he be taken off the job. And that is where December ended. And goodness knows what will happen during January.
Well, he'll get his 2-week severance, so, you know, it's still another.
It seems to me that, from what I've read, that all this is happening before Apple have actually presented their new policy.
Well, that's the weird thing, yeah, because he's supposed to be there.
They haven't actually presented anything. He's spent 2 weeks asking people at Apple for interviews, which they've denied, and then he's charged them $1,100 an hour for doing so. I wish I could. I don't mind sending emails asking people for meetings if they'll pay me that much. That sounds a really good deal.
Yeah,
he's also been speaking to all sorts of people that he shouldn't necessarily be speaking to, like Johnny Ive, for example, who's responsible for design.
Seeking to talk to Johnny Ive. Well, I don't believe he succeeded.
What part of design fits into selling or marketing ebooks?
Well, to me, no. Didn't he also want access to the global warming guy?
Al Gore.
That's the one.
I can kind of see that as a board member would be setting directions and that kind of thing. But
I suppose. But yeah, Johnny Ive really isn't involved. The other thing, just to go back to something Nick mentioned there. So what the court ordered Apple to review and redo their antitrust policies and training, and gave them 90 days. And those 90 days end on January 14th. And it's my understanding that this Bromwich chap is there to ensure Apple implement those new guidelines and that those new guidelines are appropriate. But they don't exist yet, so which raises the question Nick raises. What's he here to do exactly?
Well, nothing. Until Apple actually sets whatever this new policy towards selling ebooks is going to be, he has nothing to do. Now, at which point Apple does set this new policy, yeah, fine, great, sure. Give him the paperwork, let him look at it, let him review it, let him take notes, let him do, complain to whoever he wants to complain to about it. But in the meantime, he should be pretty much hands off. Apple doesn't have to cooperate with this guy, at least until the 90 days is up.
Or until they produce the policy, which, as far as we can tell, hasn't happened yet.
I'm sorry, you're all being terribly obstructionist.
It's the whole thing is a bit nuts. And something else that caught my eye, to wrap this up on a slightly happier note. Now, this is technically not news, because this technically happened 9 months ago, but it didn't seem to make the media until now. But there was a chap, let me just make sure I get his name right, because he deserves credit here. Bob Cohn was filing an amicus brief on this case before the judge had actually ruled, and basically the page limit was 5 pages, and he had 95 pages of legal argument, and he needed to condense those into as convincing an argument as possible with 5 ickle pages. And he, in my opinion, very cleverly decided that actually the best way to do this is as a cartoon. And in some way, so it's basically two people arguing about the case. And it's 5 pages long. It won't take you long to read. And I highly recommend anyone who's not sure what on earth is going on with this judgment, is, what it's all about, I would highly recommend you read it. And it also reminds me of something, sort of the Galileo approach that got him in a wee bit of trouble with the church, where his book was basically an argument between two people, one of them arguing one side, one of them arguing the other side, and obviously in Galileo's case, the earth goes round the sun, wins the day, and in the case of this cartoon, Apple are not guilty of antitrust violations, wins the cartoon. I really thought it was well done.
Yeah, I'm kind of going through it now. That is great.
Yeah, because I can safely say that is the only legal document I have read from start to finish.
It almost looks like a young Bill Gates.
It does a bit, actually, doesn't he?
Yeah, I had a look at the first page as I was revising this morning, and struck me as an XKCD type thing. Slightly more involved, perhaps, than some of theirs, but...
Well, longer. I've never seen theirs go to 5 pages.
Some of the XKCD ones have been rather long.
Well, there have been a few with, like, infinite scrolling and stuff, which I guess does make it technically very long.
Yeah, it would be 93 pages of words, but it's actually condensed onto one page.
Yeah, it's
single spaced. That's how they got away with it.
So, if anyone's interested, I definitely recommend that link, which I will stick into the show notes, because I don't know. I've been doing this show for this story has been on the show every time there's been an episode of this show, and so far everyone who's been on the panel has been against the judge's ruling and have felt the judge is wrong. Does anyone on today's panel feel differently to that?
No.
I can't say anything because it would be obstructionist.
Oh dear. We wouldn't want to do that. Okay. Moving on from one legal battle to another, let's get all this icky stuff out of the way is my approach to this show today. Apple v. Samsung. Of course they haven't stood still for the month of December. Apple want the court to say that Samsung have dirty hands, which sounds silly, but it's actually legally quite important. This all stems from something we talked about last month, or in November, we'll say, where, as part of the court case, Apple had to hand over sensitive documents to Samsung's lawyers. The condition that the court set on those was that they were not to be given to Samsung executives to then, because that would put them in a position to abuse insider knowledge of how Apple's doing things to try to get advantage in other negotiations. And then it turned out in November that they had actually done that. And they had, they'd used those documents to try get better deals with other people, which is obviously not on. And so Apple's response to this is to file this motion. And if they're found guilty, it actually limits some of the legal options if the judge agrees that Samsung have unclean hands, which is actually a legal term, it actually has real impact on their interaction with the court system, and it makes it impossible for them to seek certain types of injunctive relief and stuff like that. So it sounds like a silly thing, you know, unclean hands, but actually if this comes, if the court goes this way, that it's actually quite significant, and it may go some way to explaining the very last thing we'll talk about, you know, in the timeline for this story. So mentally sky that one away for now. Apple are also looking for some of their money back from this court case, because, of course, the judge found that Samsung did willingly infringe the patents. And usually, apparently, in these kind of cases, no one gets fees, everyone loses, basically. But Apple would say that because the jury found for Apple and found that it was willing patent infringement, therefore Apple should get some of their legal fees back, and they're looking for $15.7 million of said fees. Which is interesting.
Yeah, I'm wondering about this. I mean, $15.7 million in legal fees on a $900 million judgment, is that just rubbing their noses in it? Or is that the only money that they're expecting to get back anytime soon?
Well, most of the rest of it is all still under subject of appeal and stuff, isn't it? So, I don't know. It is an interesting one.
Just such pocket change compared to the major judgment.
Well, it's pocket change to either company. And when you consider that both of these companies, you know, aren't paying extra, I mean, really, when you get down to it, they're not paying extra legal fees because they have all of these law firms on retainer. So it doesn't really matter, you know, Johnny Lawyer had to put in an extra 30 hours on this case. How do we bill it? Well, you can't because we have you on retainer.
But so it's just a chess move.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it's a case of strengthening Apple's hand. If they get their way, it makes their argument stronger in the other many, many cases that are still going through the courts.
Well, and again, if I had to think about it, this is probably one of those things that Apple, you know, eventually will say, you know what? Well, we'll just forget about this one, and we'll you know, ask you for a little bit of a favorable ruling on this other one instead. You know, I mean, it's all chess, you know, chess moves on a board.
True. Something a little more concrete, because these first two are motions being filed, and it's very easy to file a motion. Getting a judgment, though, has much more real effects. And in Seoul, which is in Samsung's native Korea, there was an important case where Samsung were trying to have a bunch of Apple products banned from being imported into Korea. And the judge found that Apple did not violate the patents in question, and therefore there is no import ban. And that's on their home turf, so that's got a smart.
Oh, very much so.
Also, then, another case of a ruling. So, Judge Lucy Koh, in her court, although the court found Samsung guilty, the court also refused Apple's request for an injunction, and Apple appealed the refusal for an injunction to a federal appeals court, and the federal appeals court has come back and said that no, the judge has to hear Apple's application for that again. So they may still get their ban. Again, this is a chess move, though, because none of these products are for sale anymore. Yeah. They're all ancient, crappy products.
Yeah, it's like, what, the Galaxy 2s and Galaxy 3s. And
is it even?
It might even be older than that.
I thought it was the Galaxies and the Galaxy 2s, maybe. I didn't even think it went to the 3, let alone the 4.
Yeah, I think the newest is the 2S or something.
You know, these are old devices. But the thing is, if they win the injunction, they can then... it strengthens their hand in other court-related stuff, because they will then have successfully got an injunction, and that will affect other ongoing cases. And
there is also a provision in there that I read about that said that they can put an injunction on those specific devices that are infringed and some others that are like them in certain ways. So they can get some of the newer stuff by relation, as it were.
Unless Samsung say, well, we've implemented these workarounds. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
To me, though, the reason I've laid it out chronologically is because at the end of the month, news came that Samsung and Apple are ready to start patent talks again. Mm. And if you ask me, when you read through the news stories, it's all very one way. And it's not just true in December, that was also true in previous months. Samsung have been losing in court after court after court. It was Germany in November, now it's Seoul, some rulings that didn't quite go their way in the US. So I think that the reason that there's negotiations again is because Samsung have sort of seen. So all these chess moves, as we're calling them, I think they balance things towards Apple in these negotiations.
So in other words, their queen is exposed.
Yes. Yes, their queen is flashing some...
Let's not chess.
Some naughty bits.
That mental image.
It is a bit, isn't it? I'm not going to look at a chessboard the same way again. Thanks, guy.
Hey, it's what I do.
Nick, you're the only one with a queen to expose. Well, technically I have as well.
I was going to say, yeah, it's only actually, we're all British colonies or former colonies, apart obviously from Nick, who's British.
Oh, well, we're the Commonwealth, so.
We're not the Commonwealth anymore, we left. I didn't know you left till the 60s, though. Anyway, so that is the state of play with Apple v. Samsung, and I'm really hopeful. It's sort of my New Year's wish that these talks will happen. They'll come to a cross-licensing agreement, and I'll never have to talk about it again.
Please.
So it would be nice. It would be nice if the 2014 shows were free of this bloody case. We shall see.
Just to throw a little fly in the ointment.
Oh, poop.
What happens if Samsung comes out or starts selling, Tizen OS devices? And starts to move away from Android, how do you think that'll affect some of these cases?
I guess it depends on what negotiation they come to. Because if Samsung and Apple come to an agreement, that's not really an Android agreement. That's an agreement between Samsung and Apple.
Right, which would leave Apple free to go after other infringers with these victories under their belt.
Yeah, so I guess it's a way for Samsung to bow out. Because Samsung have kind of been taking the heat on behalf of all the vendors who sell Android products. They've sort of been acting as a heat shield. So if Apple make a negotiation with them and they stop being a heat shield, I can only imagine HTC would not be happy.
They have been a heat shield in a sense, but they have been the ones standing there saying, look at my black tiles, you can't burn me.
So. Yes, and they've also, I mean, to be fair, because they've done their own customizations on Android, they've been the easiest, they've been the lowest hanging fruit. Because they've been the most spectacular infringers and copiers. So I guess I can see why if Apple were going to choose someone to make an example of...
Go after the biggest target first.
Yeah.
Well, they're also the most successful just commercially, period.
True. and they advertise the most as well. They spend a phenomenal amount of money advertising their products.
Using Apple graphics on some occasions.
Yeah, whoops.
Well, not only that, but yeah, or and not only that, but actually filming, you know, supposedly in front of an Apple store. No, no, they weren't, but you know, that was the impression that they were leaving.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's just a New Year's resolution on both their parts. You know, Samsung, talk to smarmy Apple. Apple's New Year's list. Talk to those pains, Samsung.
Talk to those copycats.
Check. Yeah.
We shall see what comes of it. They've been in talks before. I'm trying to remember why they broke up. Of course, we never really know. But I think it was Samsung who walked away. I think, and I may be wrong, so don't take my word for it.
Couldn't agree on terms.
As I recall, it was, you know, they basically were holding hostage some, what do they call those patents?
Standard essential.
Yeah, essential. Yeah, Fran patents, and you know, basically wanted Apple to give up some of their non-Fran patents in exchange, and when Apple wouldn't play deal with that, they, you know, tried raising the prices of those Fran patents, and all hell broke loose.
Yeah, and I think really that's been the asymmetry here, is that Apple may be infringing some, not all that, sorry, Apple is infringing Frand patents, standards essential patents, to which they have the right to free, reasonable, non-discriminatory
pricing on those patents, right?
Yeah, ND, non-discriminatory, yeah. And the other way around, it's not the same, because Samsung aren't infringing. Yeah.
they are infringing on non-Frand patents.
Yes. Which means Apple have no legal obligation to give Frand terms. Apple can simply say, we're keeping our intellectual property ours, we're not licensing this. And you can do that if it's not standards essential, but you can't do that if it is standards essential. And for a patent to become standards essential, the company has to agree to adding it into the standards, but that's one of those swings and roundabouts things. If you agree to let your patent go into a standard, then the swing is that everyone who implements a standard has to pay you money because it's part of the standard. This, you know, the roundabout to that swing is that you have to charge them these fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory prices. And
right, everybody gets charged the same.
Yeah, and
in theory,
and it shouldn't be extortionate, but unfortunately Samsung kind of wanted it both ways. They wanted to get money from everyone and to be able to hold Apple over a barrel, and the European Union in particular got very cranky at them for that. So I can see why they're back at the table, and hopefully this time
just get it over with. My God.
Right.
I mean, isn't everyone just so tired of hearing about this case?
Yes.
Well, Bart keeps bringing it back up.
But it's news. We're here to talk. We don't have to like the news.
We just have to deal with it.
We just have to deal with it, yeah. So, anyway, I think we've dealt with it enough. I'm going to move us into a happy story. A trend I noticed while looking through my news reader is that there are a lot of stories of... Basically, people do surveys. That's what people do. And... Each survey should be taken with a grain of salt, but sometimes a pattern emerges amidst all of these surveys, and it does, I think, make you stop and look up. So I'm just going to read through these here in the order that they happened. So the December news covers basically the holiday season, so the results from Black Friday through to Christmas sales numbers. So we start off with some numbers from IBM, who are hardly a non-reputable source, about what devices people were using to purchase things on Black Friday. So I guess this is the buying of Christmas presents. And for those using mobile, 83% of those were on iOS, which again brings up that question that Apple have jokingly asked. If all of these Android devices are out there, why aren't they active online? Why aren't they doing things?
Because they can't.
Or because most of them are only smartphones in theory, and the people who buy them are just looking for a dumb phone and they use them as a dumb phone. I don't know. I guess there's lots of excuses, but 83% of the traffic buying stuff was iOS, and 17% was Android. And that's quite skewed. And maybe there's a margin of error on those numbers, but it seems very unlikely IBM got it so wrong that iOS aren't a clear majority.
Let's face it, Apple make it very easy to buy stuff.
Well, we're not just talking about stuff that was bought from Apple.
Yeah. I mean,
it's basically anything anybody bought with a mobile device. 83% of them that did buy something with a mobile device bought it with an iOS device as compared to an Android device.
Misunderstood.
So yeah. IBM are looking basically at the logs from major retailers.
Yeah.
And so it's people buying stuff, not buying stuff from Apple, but buying stuff with Apple products rather than from Apple. It's an interesting number, but it doesn't necessarily mean Apple made a lot of money. It just shows that iPads are in use a lot. So the next story then is that, no surprise, a lot of people bought iPads on Black Friday. But InfoScout had a number that said that they poll shoppers, sort of like the way, I guess it's sort of like the way people do TV ratings. You have these, 90,000 shoppers and you poll them. And 40% of the people who did buy an iPod, or iPad, sorry, Jesus, iPod buying, that's quaint. 40% of iPad purchasers are Android phone users, which is another trend that's becoming apparent, that although people buy Android phones and like them, that doesn't seem to translate to the tablet market. People seem perfectly happy to have a Galaxy fablety thing and an iPad. So,
don't people say that there's very little difference between an Android phone and an Android tablet, in that a lot of the tablet apps are just scaled up phone apps anyway? So if you've already got one, why would you buy just a bigger screen to run the same apps? I mean, content consumption would be one thing, but I also wonder, people buying iPads versus Androids, does that include things like the Kindle Fire?
I don't know is the answer to that.
Because I suspect a lot of people...
My guess would be yes.
I would have thought a lot of people who do buy an Android tablet for consumption, because they are reasonably good at, or very good at that in some cases, would be buying the likes of the Kindle Fire or HD Fire or whatever they're calling it now.
HDX 2 squared something.
Yeah, well, you see, what strikes me, right? So you have, especially if you have one of these fablety things, I mean, the Android are differentiating themselves from iOS in large part by size, physically. And if you have one of those big phones, the vast majority of Android tablets are 7-inch. There's not that much of a difference between some of these 5-inch phones and those 7-inch tablets. Whereas if you have a 5-inch tablet, or 5-inch phone, a 10-inch tablet actually is a significant size difference, especially if you want a consumption device.
Yes. I bought my son I can't even think of what the name of it was. It was super dirt cheap. 10.1-inch running Android 4.2. It was like $100.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a bad little tablet, but I know what it was that my son was looking for. Now, when he first had gone to college, I had given him my first generation iPad and a Bluetooth keyboard, and basically told him, when you're in class and you want to take notes, this is a great device to this. It's connected up through Wi-Fi, and I was set him up with a Dropbox account and all the rest of this, so it's constantly saving. You can use this tablet and go back and forth between this and your laptop and get all your stuff done. Well, by the time he came back from his first semester, he handed me the iPad and says, really not using it that much. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he also was using an Android phone and was doing most of what it was he wanted to do with that, as compared to lugging around a 9-inch tablet.
Yeah, I also think that geeks particularly who buy Android phones because they personally think they're better than iPhones.
Well, that's fine.
Are actually looking for something that's good. And when they look at all the tablets, they go for what they think is best. Therefore, they go for an iPad. It's not necessarily that they're sold completely on Android. It's just they want what they see as best.
Yeah.
Makes because sense. A phone is a much more personal device that you live with every hour of every day. You want it to work exactly how you need it to work. Whereas the tablet's just something you go to periodically to do a specific task, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I'm now one of those people who has an Android phone but still has an iPad.
So you're in the 40%?
Yes. Except I didn't buy it recently.
Well, the next numbers we have are from Parks Associates, and this is obviously, again, we're going through these chronologically, so this is before Christmas actually happened. Parks Associates polled people for planned holiday purchases, and one of the questions they asked was, if you're planning to buy a desktop computer, how quaint, which one are you planning to buy? And Apple beat Dell in those numbers, which is interesting.
Dell is having their own problems these days as far as their computer business goes. I see, you know, Dell is going through the same kind of pain that HP was going through, without the diversity that HP has. So unfortunately for Dell, they don't really have anything else to fall back on. HP had, you know, they've got printers, they've got, all these other fingers. Well,
they're in network gear. I mean, because HP bought 3Com, they're competing with Cisco in terms of network stuff. They compete in the server market. They clearly do the printer thing very well. HP have a lot of stuff on the go, whereas, God bless them.
Dell is cheap computers.
Yeah, they're cheap computers. They have a server market. They're pretty good in the server space. They're better than HP in the server space, in my professional opinion. But their attempts to get into consumer stuff like MP3 players, they didn't go well.
It's a joke.
Yeah, they were just a joke, is the best way to say it. So what strikes me about this is, A, that the desktop market still exists, but it seems to me that what's happened is the overall numbers of desktops sold is going way down every year. But the people who still buy them are people like me. People who want a real powerhouse of a machine. People like me are buying iMacs. 27-inch iMacs are the truck. And the cars are rapidly becoming laptops and tablets. But the people who want desktops want Mac Pros and iMacs. And Dell have a sort of a kind of a clone of an iMac. But you can put it next to a real one and no one's going to go, ooh, that Dell one looks nice.
Is that the whole story, though? Or is that just amongst our circle? I would have thought that the average person on the street who walks into a big box store on the main road would say, I want to buy a computer because my old one's dead, buried, whatever.
But I don't think they're buying desktops. I don't think leaving with a desktop.
If it's a family, wouldn't they buy a desktop?
Not necessarily. I think if you go into one of the big box shifter stores like PC World in the UK and have a look around, it's all laptops.
Yeah, true.
I mean, there are maybe one or two all-in-ones tucked away somewhere, and there will be a table of Apple stuff.
I often think of my brother's family as being a very typical family, because I got all the tech genes in the family and my brother got none of them. And I think his family is quite typical, as there is a family laptop. It's a laptop because it moves from room to room in the house.
Depending on who needs it.
Yeah, but I don't think it leaves the house. So it's sort of a laptop used as a portable desktop. And I think a lot of families are going that way. So in terms of the desktop market, what's holding strong are the power machines for power users. And in that space, Dell have never been particularly strong.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the other question I would have about this survey is, how many people... Yeah, I mean, go back 10 years even and say, I'm going to buy a Dell. Or would they say, I'm going to buy a PC and then shop around for what was cheapest?
In Ireland...
Because it's not like with Apple, where when you say, I'm going to buy an iMac or a MacBook Pro, it's a very specific thing you're buying. But if you're not going to buy Apple and you're going to buy a PC, wouldn't you shop around between at least HP, Dell, and maybe Lenovo?
I don't think Ireland is typical here, because Dell had... until they got rid of it, a strong manufacturing presence in this ickle country. And their ads were always basically, you can't buy our PCs in stores, but we'll give you a fantastic deal if you come straight to us. So in Ireland, actually, Dell had a high profile. But then they closed their factory and laid off thousands of people, and they still had a high profile, but not in the good way. So here people would have said, I'm going out to buy a Dell, or it certainly would have been in their consciousness. But I don't think that probably doesn't hold up worldwide.
And well, is this iOS with Android, you know, comparing Apple computers with Dells and HPs and Lenovos and
Yeah. Well, and Bob's Crab Shack and computer sales.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's all thrown into one. I think the biggest problem that is facing the PC market, and it's part of the reason I think why Apple sales have remained relatively consistent, even as, you know, the rest of the PC market seems to be dropping off, is Windows 8. People just don't seem to really want it.
That's what's coming standard
on all these new computers.
People are saying, I need to change. I have to learn something new. Maybe now is the time to do that Apple thing I've been putting off. Maybe. Nick, you were trying to jump in there?
It was just to say, I think the reason they've chosen Dell as opposed to Hewlett-Packard or whatever is that Dell were one of the largest sellers of desktop computers recently, within the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's a valid comparison, because if you looked at all the desktop sales, Dell were getting a good chunk of them.
And the other thing, of course, is that this is purely consumers. So this is not counting the many, many desktops that still grace people's offices. So even that's changing to laptops in a lot of places. But there are still an awful lot of cheap, frankly, crappy boxes sitting on people's desks that are purchased by an IT manager and not chosen by the person who has to type on them.
Right.
And Dell are still selling a lot of those, and Apple are certainly not outselling Dell in that market.
But they're not even trying, though. You know, Apple has never really gone after the business market. They've basically said, okay, well, here's our line of computers, and it's all consumer-based because that's the people that buy them. And if you want to buy an iMac or a Mac Mini or 10 for your office, well, okay, you know, here they are. But they're not custom configuring three or four different models. Okay, well, let's see. We need the models for the worker bees, and then we need the models for the worker bee supervisors, and then we need the model for their supervisors, and then the executives. You know, I mean, they're not doing that. They're saying, here's our computer. You know, from our store, you can put in a larger hard drive. You can put in more RAM. And then they say, well, what if we don't want this particular graphics configuration? Oh, well, we don't care. That's what we give you.
Well, this is where resellers come in, though, because, I mean, I work in the education sector, and being Ireland and the public sector, we have all sorts of rules for procurement and stuff. And we don't buy our Apple stuff from Apple. We buy our Apple stuff from a reseller who does do things the way we want them done. But, of course, Apple don't care, because they're just selling it to the reseller who sells it to us. So they're still getting their money. They just don't have an account manager. Whereas with Dell, there is a person with a name and an email address who's our account manager, who I can pick up the phone to and say, I need blah, 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 and he will send me a quote within, you know, a very short amount of time. And Apple just don't bother their backsides with any of that, because people don't buy Macs in a work environment because the IT manager wants them to. The Macs come into work because the worker bee says, no, I want a Mac, and I'll be way more efficient if you get me one.
Right.
You know, it's completely the other way around. It's the workers asking instead of the managers deciding. It's very different, and yet they do make it in.
The funny thing I find is that my company's a very large New Zealand company, and we have Lenovo laptops as standard. And, you know, they were getting refreshed every 3 years until we started cutting back recently. Hmm. And here's a picture of our esteemed executives, and on the table between them, MacBook Pro, MacBook Air, and two iPads connected to the company network.
That's how they get in, isn't it? Because you can't say no to a manager. It's that's how iPhones get in. It's over BlackBerry. That's Apple's way in.
iPhones are huge in number.
Yeah. Anyway, the next statistic, we won't use the word statistic. The next survey, ChangeWave, who are also quite reputable. Also, again, we're talking before Christmas, so it hasn't happened yet. They polled prospective tablet purchasers to ask them, are you planning to buy an iPad or something else? And 72% of people were planning to buy an iPad rather than anything else. And unsurprisingly, when the actual numbers came in after the fact, so IBM released numbers after Christmas genuinely had happened and people had done their purchasing, and found that the iPad outsold Android tablets by a factor of 5 to 1. which is 80%, which really isn't far off what ChangeWave said was going to happen.
Which is that pattern you pointed out, is that a lot of them are saying that the iPad is the tablet,
yeah,
period.
Right. And it does rather make Tim, I mean, we all sort of laughed at Tim Cook and said, oh, it's going to be an iPad Christmas. Yeah, whatever, Tim, you know, revolutionary, not revolutionary, was what all of the analysts said. But you know something, 5-1, that's an iPad Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's the good news. And I guess also in the good news pile, if analysts wish for something long enough, sometimes it happens, although I still don't think it's going to be a TV. But I guess I'll jump to the end of this one and say that finally, Apple have a deal with China Mobile. And as of the 17th of January, China Mobile customers, and there are 700 million of those, can choose to buy an iPhone. What is also slightly, what I thought was slightly interesting, is that October sales numbers, which obviously predate this deal significantly, show a 12% rise in iPhone sales in China anyway. So it does seem to be all, you know, good news.
Well, I mean, we'll have to wait until the end of March when Apple has their second quarter results before we'll see, you know, what kind of impact China Mobile or any. And let's, you know, these are all rumored purchases. I mean, there's no hard numbers to go along with this. But so we'll have to wait until the second quarter results to see what kind of impact this deal with China Mobile had with iPhones or iOS devices in general.
Yeah, it may even be a slow burner. It may take a year until it's really into its full stride. We shall see. The next thing I want to talk about, I've sort of lumped it together in my mind as the Snowden fallout, because a lot of news stories, frankly, for this year, whether it be in the Apple sphere or the general sphere, have, you know, got Snowden in them somewhere. So I guess the first pattern is that the tech companies, now that the world knows, the tech companies are free to finally voice their opinion on what they're being asked to do by the government, and so the tech companies are very quick to come together to say, we want there to be change, and Apple is taking part in that. So Apple got together with other tech companies to send an open letter to the president. Tim Cook and a bunch of other execs got to meet President Obama face-to-face. In theory, that was to talk about healthcare reform, but the tech executives seemed quite keen to steer the agenda towards NSA stuff. So that's, I guess, the good side. Apple are fighting the fight that we as Apple users probably want them to fight. The not-so-good side, then, is that a German security researcher called Jacob Applebaum, so Jacob Appletree, which is an interesting name for someone who's about to reveal some stuff about Apple, he discovered that the NSA have access to iOS malware, which can be installed surreptitiously by the NSA, and once it is installed, they will basically phone home with copies of your text messages and can turn on and off your camera and your mic to see what you're up to and all that kind of pleasantries. And now, he said in his paper that either there's lots and lots of... I believe he put it as either Apple are collaborating or they write shit software, which doesn't seem like a very nice choice. Apple, I guess, Apple didn't say, oh, we write shit software, but what they did say was that we in absolutely in no way cooperate with the NSA on this. And hopefully the various vulnerabilities being exploited by this NSA malware will be patched by Apple, and it'll become harder for the NSA to do this kind of stuff.
Well, has it actually been verified that this iOS malware can be installed on any iOS 6 or 7 device, or are we talking mostly about jailbroken devices?
It hasn't
been proven it can be installed on any device. There is one slide which has been leaked that says, hey, we can do this.
Ah,
that's it.
So it's got 6 or 7 words.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like, I mean, it's not inconceivable, though, because all software has bugs. And we've seen, what was it called again? Well, Flame was one example, but the more famous one with the nuclear stuff in Iran, Stuxnet. If you as a government do some research and find 0 days and don't report them to the vendor, you can give yourself an effective backdoor for quite some time. And if the rate at which you find new 0 days is sufficient, you can just keep it up. And the only reason Stuxnet ever got out was because it sort of got out. It was supposed to be targeting stuff and then it went a bit off target. It's possible, but that doesn't mean it's happening.
Or that it's even probable.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I would be shocked if they weren't trying. Whether or not they have succeeded as well as their slide implies is a whole different question.
Oh, and from this, a public service announcement. If you're using a 2008 model iPhone with 2008 level software, be careful.
Yeah, stop.
that's where this was pointing.
Yeah.
By the way, if you're using this device, why?
Right. I don't think people... I guess there's a certain awareness that there's malware problems on Android. But even there, they're only sort of up and coming. They're not an everyday occurrence where people are being bitten day in, day out, and it's become sort of like Windows 98 kind of territory. That hasn't happened yet. And it really, really hasn't happened on iOS. So there's a certain complacency that we don't think these phones in our pocket are computers. But they are. And, you know, the update to from iOS 6 to iOS 7, it isn't just about making the interface pretty. There's a whole batter of security stuff patched in that update.
Yeah, and iPhones in general are probably one of the most secure general-purpose computers ever devised.
Apple are striving for a very secure by design architecture. They will make mistakes, and therefore there will be vulnerabilities. But if you're striving for a secure by design, that does make it more secure than if you're making mistakes while not striving for a secure by design, because the mistakes are going to happen anyway. So it's interesting stuff, and I guess Apple were very, very quick to say no, we are not collaborating, with the implication of they're just using bugs, which hopefully now will get squished.
And that's a real statement of fact. It's not some slide that somebody found somewhere that's several years old.
Yeah. The way I would look at a lot of these NSA slides is that they're aspirational rather than necessarily factual. Because I'm sure they aspire to be able to break into every iPhone.
Well, I'd love to.
Yeah. And maybe they can even break into some, maybe even many. But, you know... anyway, we don't know, I guess, is what a lot of this comes down to. One of the last sort of groups of stories I had down as sort of our main topics for today is one that, I have a personal horse in the race. I'm in favour of equality and stuff like that, because it kind of affects me. I'd like to be married and I can't be married, and I would like that to change. And Tim Cook is of a very similar opinion, and I guess one of the reasons I really want to stick this in the show notes is... I don't remember Apple getting involved in politics under a certain Mr. Jobs. Do I misremember?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
As a matter of fact, when Steve Jobs, as far as the company was concerned, was all, okay, it's about Apple and our devices. We don't talk about what charities we support. We don't talk about what kind of rights for workers or lifestyles or anything else that other people have that, you know, that may or may not, you know, fall within the realms of the products that we sell. They basically, with Jobs, it was everything is about Apple, everything is about our devices.
Oh, you could be less generous and say everything's about me.
Yeah. Okay.
But I see what you're saying. So there's two halves to this story this month. So the first half is Tim Cook speaking, not as Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, but speaking as Tim Cook, former student of Auburn University. And he gave a speech, and I'm going to stick the link to a video of the speech into the show notes. It's not long. It's 13 and a bit minutes. And it's quite a personal story, and basically why Tim Cook, the person, feels that equality is so important. And he basically starts by saying that as a child, he witnessed cross burnings in Alabama and it affected him greatly. He felt it was wrong. He felt history would judge that it was wrong, and he wanted to be against stuff like that. And he makes a very, very good case that what matters is that everyone does a little, and those littles will come together and it will make real change. And he makes I think it's just worth watching. It's just a really good appeal for everyone just to do a little to make everyone's lives better, which is nice. And that's Tim Cook, the person. But
right.
Tim Cook, the Apple CEO, also made some statements to that effect in his official capacity, because he wrote a letter to all Apple employees, and in some regards it's kind of the usual fodder. Thanks very much, we did some great products, name check a few things Apple did this year, aren't we great? And then the argument of, and the reason this is possible is because we have a diverse workforce and we protect those that workforce, and we do more than the law requires us, and that's only right. And that's new. And it caught my eye as being new and different.
Well, I mean, it really comes down to you want to have the best possible people to create or do, you know, whatever it is that your job is, or whatever it is that your company does. Hmm. And outside of what it is that they do for your company, what freaking difference does it make, you know, how they live their lives or what they do in the privacy of their own homes, short of actually, you know, circumventing the law or you know, there are extremes, of course, in any direction that you want to go. But really, as far as lifestyle, just to put a general term on it, what people do in the privacy of their own homes is, you know, kind of up to them between, you know, two of age adults, and the rest of it shouldn't really matter.
Well, the clue in that phrase, Guy, is privacy.
Yeah, boy. Well, thank you for summing that up, because I was having a real tough time with it.
I guess the other way you could sum it up is live and let live.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And Tim Cook has a few times this year, I've sort of stuck them in the show notes as they've happened, he's been speaking out in favour of ENDA, which is not in Ireland that's a guy's name, which is the name of our Prime Minister. But it's also the Employment Non-Discrimination Act in the United States of America. And the other thing he did this year, which wasn't this month, is he wrote an article explaining the financial and economic case for equality. Which, if you're trying to actually change hearts and minds, that's kind of a good approach.
Yep.
Mm.
Although he did say in the speech that I recommend people watch, he says, there are economic reasons, but you should do it because it's the right thing to do, not because it makes economic sense. Which I kind of also agree with.
Well, I mean, the one is more important than the latter.
Yeah, it's good.
The first is more important than the latter.
Asking people to do the right thing despite the fact that it will hurt them economically is a very different appeal than asking people to do the right thing, oh, and by the way, it'll also be good for you.
It makes sense economically, right?
Yeah, it's an easier sell that way. I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts on this. I have a feeling we're kind of all singing off the same hymn sheet, which doesn't necessarily make for a good podcast, but it does make me feel better.
Yes, we are.
The last section, we're at our hour, but I'm going to continue on for a little bit longer if you guys have time.
Sure.
I just have a collection of littler stories that I have that I think are important in the big picture. BlackBerry have posted losses of $4.4 billion, and I don't know how long a company can go like that.
Stick a fork in them, they're done.
It makes me sad, but I fear you're right. A better news story, though, is I'm seeing, slowly but surely, there is more sense coming out of Redmond. So in the November show, we talked about the end of the stack rank, and although Alison was against it, I'm still in favour of it ending, and the rest of the panel were on my side on that. Sorry, Alison. And this month, a Microsoft executive called Julie Larson-Green was speaking, and she sort of outlined a new vision for the future of Microsoft, which is not a 3OS vision. So right now there's real Windows 8, there's Windows RT, and there's phone Windows 8. And in the future vision she outlined, it would be just two. It would be real Windows 9 or whatever they're going to call it, and Windows Phone 9 or whatever they're going to call it. And instead of the cheap tablets being a stripped-down version of big Windows, they would be iOS-like, sort of a scaled up version of little Windows. So a very Apple sort of approach, and I hope this is what comes to pass, and that consumers of Microsoft tablets have an easier time of things.
Yeah, well, I read this as Microsoft puts finger at corner of mouth and says, it did work for Apple, didn't it?
Good.
I think that where Microsoft made their biggest mistake wasn't Windows RT. Windows RT, from the little bit that I've played with them, works fine. And it's not a bad tablet OS, and it's not like Android, and it's not like iOS. It's something new, something different, for which I applaud Microsoft for. Their mistake was at the same time that they're announcing Windows RT, at the very end of that announcement, they say, oh, that's right, and in 3 months, Windows 8 is coming out, and it's going to look just like this too. And at that point, you could have heard all the developers in the room going, well, why the hell should we bother to develop software or applications for Windows RT when the Windows Pro is coming out 3 months later, and that'll be the one everybody wants? And so you've got three devices. You've got the phone, you've got the tablet, and you've got the desktop that all pretty much look the same, but none of them can run each other's software. And for that, Microsoft should be slapped right on the wrist and told to go sit in the corner for a half hour because somebody, was really not thinking that out. They had just kind of put the whole Windows Vista debacle behind them, and the marketplace was really embracing Windows 7. And Windows 7 is, frankly, it's I like it. I think it's a good OS. I'm not going to trade it, my Mac away for it, but I think it's a good OS. Should have left that alone. Windows RT should have been their mobile platform, and you just keep two of them separate. You don't do this mind meld all at once and expect the all of your customers to know the difference between an Atom-based computer and an Intel-based computer.
I guess it made sense to geeks in a room somewhere.
They've been trying this for 10 years to have their cake and eat it too, to make everything look alike, regardless of whether everything looking alike fits well within the parameters of the devices that they're trying to sell. And it's stupid.
As I would have said many times on different shows when Windows 8 was coming out, my finger is not a mouse or my mouse is not a finger. Don't confuse the two.
Right. And well, they did.
Yeah. And by making developers write three versions of their apps, that's 50% more of an ask than Apple saying write two.
Yep.
And when Apple say write two, the actual underlying SDKs and stuff are very similar across the two because the actual development platform is the same. It's Xcode with effectively the descendant of NextStep.
Yep.
Hopefully.
I made a comment a little while ago on the MyMac G Plus community. I think that Apple are going not exactly in the same direction. I think they're doing it properly, and that is they're taking iOS and they're taking OS 10, and they are going to merge at some point. There'll still be different experiences depending on what device you use on it, but they'll merge the code base so that it's even easier to program for the two.
So basically you hit a checkbox on whether you want it for Intel or whether you want it for Atom-based processors.
Yeah, and particularly as we've now got 64-bit processors on the phones, the more powerful they get, the closer I think the two are going to get together. And I think where people have been worrying about OS X and iOS becoming the same thing, I don't think they ever will be fully. The experience will still be different.
It's for what matters to
the
user. But
the code will be the same.
Yeah, what matters to the user is interface. And for developers, that's a layer, but it's not the process. And so
precisely.
To get a bit too nerdy here, when you're writing stuff using Xcode, you create these things called nib files, which are basically your interface bit. And you tie buttons and clicky things or tappy things, depending on whether you're using which API you're going for, you tie those events to code which does something. And so I can see the future you're describing where a developer writes the actual code to do the work once and then creates two interfaces with different clicky things, so tappy things being tied to the same functionality as clicky things. And so the developer writes two UIs to one app. And as long as they're writing two UIs, from my point of view as the user, I am getting a finger-oriented interface where I need it and a mouse-oriented interface where I need it. And I, as the user, am not going to think they're the same OS, but they are. And I hope that's true.
To a certain extent, they're already doing it, aren't they? Because, I mean, you have to write slightly different interfaces for the iPad and the iPhone. So they're already three-quarters of the way there, in my opinion.
Yeah, and a lot of the like core audio and stuff is already very similar across the platforms. I don't do very much of this kind of development because I hate Objective-C. But I know that at the low level, a lot of their stuff is already the same.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's going to be a day when suddenly it becomes true that Apple has this one OS. Because depending on how you define it, that might be true. It's probably 95% true today, or maybe it's only 80% true today, and tomorrow it'll be 81%. I don't think there's ever going to be a moment. But we may at some point look back and go, hang on a second, they've become the same.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I guess...
All I can say, Bart, is Java. Java.
Don't do Java. Where Java went wrong is they wrote... No, Java insisted on the one UI layer across all operating systems. You know, they took a swing and a miss, if you'll excuse the terrible programming pun. Apple don't seem to be making that mistake, I hope. Anyway, that was supposed to be a short story. These things never go the way I expect. The other one, which I know is going to be important in hindsight, and I just couldn't really be bothered to care about, is that Apple launched iBeacons.
Yeah, I'm not even really sure. I mean, I keep hearing about that, but I'm not really sure what that is.
Well,
I think they're solving a problem that nobody has at this point. You know, if I walk into an Apple store, well, number one, I have to get on a plane to do that, but let's not dwell on that. If I walk into an Apple store, either I'm just going there to look because it's a fun kind of thing to do, or I'm going there for something specific. The only question I have when I walk into a shop is, where is such and such? They don't appear to be solving that. Unless I'm supposed to walk around the whole shop and just, no, phone's quiet. Oh, phone's telling me about this. No, that's not what I want. Phone's telling me about, oh, that's the one. It must be near me. Now, it just doesn't seem like it solves any problem that I have. I don't want to walk around a shop, and basically what they seem to have created is that pesky shop assistant that won't leave you alone.
See, I'm not sure if that...
It's like a movable billboard almost.
Yeah, but the thing is, the actual iBeacon's underlying technology doesn't have to be like that. So
they've
sort of implemented something to show that they have something, but I'm not sure if we're actually seeing what it's for yet, because I think a bit like when they let developers use the dock connector for stuff and they had a few demos, we didn't really know what it was going to do until developers actually got their hands on it. Because in theory, this is effectively GPS indoors. Yeah. And that means that you could write an app, as I understand it, where you could ask, let's say probably the best app in the world, you click a button and it just draws arrows on the screen of where the nearest toilet is.
Right? That would be a handy app.
Right. Yeah. Or restroom, whatever we're going to say across the world. I mean, I think this is one of those things where we'll look back a bit like the motion sensor in the iPhone. We all thought, that's interesting, but we didn't really know if it was going to be any good until people started making apps. And now I can hold my phone up to the sky and it tells me what the airplane is. It tells me what the stars are. It's just actually really cool and useful. But at the time, we didn't know. And maybe this time next year, when we're looking back, we'll say, well, actually, this was the start of something wonderful. Or this might turn out to be a technology that actually wasn't needed and it'll just fizzle and die like other things have done in the past. So that's kind of why I didn't put in the show notes, because I don't know.
Well, especially because a lot of the Apple stores are very small, aren't they?
The little Apple stores seem like a really bad fit. Maybe the New York store and the Paris store and that giganta London store, maybe they're a good fit, but your average Apple store seems like a really bad fit.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I get the sense that the panel is sort of also in wait-and-see mode. Something else that crossed my eye that just made me laugh and cry. So HTC, to explain why they're so slow at getting updates of Android out to people, drew a little infographic showing quite how difficult it is to get an Android update out to people.
And little, bad?
It's a bloody big diagram, actually. I'd hate to have to print it on real paper. It's a bureaucratic, technological nightmare. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, I don't think I can do it justice. You just got to look at this thing and have your jaw drop and go, oh my goodness, my gosh. Apple have it so much easier because they make the OS, they make the hardware, they just do it. And Android can't have that. And that's, I guess, always going to be a problem for them.
Well, most of these companies have kind of their own version of Android that they put onto their phones, but from within the company, like say you're HTC and you've got five different phones. But when those phones were released, you have basically the same version of Android that you have kind of changed all the way across. So why can't you take Google's update, change it for those devices that you have, and then push it out to people?
Well, the extra complication of the Google Certify stuff, because Google call Android open, but it's a very, very closed kind of open, where you basically have to meet all sorts of their rules in order to be allowed to be Android. And that means that there's a lot of stakeholders. And the other problem, of course, is that Apple basically told the carriers to swivel on it, and yep. HTC have
good
not.
Move, Apple.
And so HTC have Google telling them what to do and having to approve everything, and all other carriers telling them what to do and having to approve everything. So by the time it gets to the poor end user's phone, I mean, so many people have had to argue about it. Obviously, it takes ages. Because the bit where developers get to write code is a small segment, because they sort of split the infographic into sort of phases. And the writey code phase is annoyingly small. Anyway, I think people are just going to have to read it and be horrified.
Yeah, I hadn't realised, just having a quick look at it now, I hadn't realised that the chipset manufacturer has to be involved as well.
Which Apple are too, so Apple kind of have three hats on. Because they're making their own silicon, they're assembling their own devices, and they're writing their own OS. So all of this stuff is just Apple engineers on the iOS side, which is easier. Speaking of Apple engineers, the Mac Pro's out, and I think hell may have frozen over, because iFixit have just given an Apple product an 8 out of 10 for repairability.
My word.
I wish I had a lightning sound effect that I could throw in right now.
It is kind of staggering, though, isn't it? It's not what we're used to anymore. I mean, the first two reports were, it has a socketed CPU, but as iFixit went deeper into it, you can basically change everything that's important out of these devices, and not a suction cup in sight. So it really is a pro machine designed to grow with you like the big towers could, but in a ickle circle.
Itty bitty living space.
Yeah. It's I like it.
I quite like that story, because there were a lot of people beforehand, when the first news came out that the CPU was, you know, socketed, people said, oh yeah, but all the rest will be soldered in. No. Yes. And everybody was taking a really negative stance on the machine, saying it's too different, it's too this, it's too that, it's too the other. And I think
did they also do that when the iMac was first released?
Oh well, yes.
But it doesn't have a floppy drive. What?
Oh, that iMac, yeah,
yeah,
that's true.
So there's been a lot of, you know, hey, wow, this is a fancy machine, but there's also a lot of negative undercurrent. And for iFixit to come out and say, you know what, this is the most repairable and therefore upgradable Mac that Apple have made in the last probably 4 or 5 years. It's a nice snub in the face of those people who perpetuate that negative undercurrent. It's an amazing machine, period.
And there's a second negative undercurrent that also got a good chop on the head. So as well as the common wisdom being that Apple computers are not repairable, the other bit of common wisdom is that they're overpriced. So let me just make sure I give credit to the right people here. So the guys at FutureLux went, okay, here is a very expensive computer. Sorry, a very costly computer. What would happen if I went out and just tried to buy bits and build my own? Can I DIY myself one of these new Mac Pros for less money? And the answer is no, they couldn't. So it's...
Well, from within the parameters of how they were trying to do it, which was an incredibly small form factor, And that was probably the biggest cost killer right there. What was trying to match the new Mac Pro in size. Now, if you took more, and this is the argument that I've seen in a lot of forum posts that are related to this, if you took those same components and didn't necessarily want something that looked like a small box or a small trash can, then yes, you could build a Windows / Linux desktop computer that was just as powerful as a Mac Pro for less money, but it's still not the same thing as this particular Mac Pro. But as far as the raw power goes, no. As a matter of fact, it was probably, because I think the new Mac Pro starts at about $3,000.
Yeah, $299. So yeah, $3,000.
Yeah. I think because even the processors on this thing are like incredibly expensive. It was probably a difference of $400 to $600.
I mean, these are not like these machines. They have basically server innards.
Yeah,
and you should, when you're looking at prices, don't compare them to a desktop computer, because these innards are way more powerful than that. And don't look at it in terms of the raw megahertz of the CPUs. There's way much more going on inside your computer than raw megahertz in that one place. So, I mean, these are.
I'm talking about using those same processors, but just not trying to condense it down into
I'm sort of saying it for the benefit of the audience, really, because I know a lot of people will look at the raw gigahertz of the CPUs and say, "But that's
which
not
is
that
meaningless,
special." Right? Yeah, because what's actually important is the onboard buses and things to shove data around between all of those components spectacularly efficiently, and that's the difference between a Xeon and a Pentium, or a Core these days, rather than a Pentium.
But will the illustration?
The illustration of the megahertz problem. If you look at some of the other Mac lines, if you upgrade to a more expensive version, you get a lower clock speed, but you get more cores.
Yeah, that too, actually. Yeah. So each core.
But will it run Crysis?
I think it will.
My wallet would be in Crysis.
Yeah, it may cause a few crises. Before we finish up, I want to get one more story in, and this is going to have an effect long term. So, making new standards is a slow and lumbering process, and USB 3 is now bedded in, so obviously it's time to start thinking about USB 4. And there's no detailed design yet, there's no picture even we can go and look at, but there is a sort of a statement of intent. And I would argue Apple have certainly had at least some effect on things, because one of the things in that statement of intent is a reversible connector.
Yep.
So, hallelujah, but of course, don't expect to have one of these in your pocket next week. This is the start of a slow process. People are saying 2015 at the earliest sort of dates. And I really hope that the EU are very slow at making laws, because the EU are continuing with their quest to force USB on everyone. And if the EU get their way before USB 4, that would mean that Apple users have to take a serious downgrade in Europe. And I hope to goodness it doesn't come to that.
Well, didn't they just include a at the time, 30-pin to, mini or micro USB connector in with their devices?
And they did, but there's a new law making its way through that they want actually, none of this messing around. You got to really have USB. And what's at the core of this is a desire to cut down on waste, particularly of stuff that contains copper. And so the idea would be that in future in Europe, when you buy a phone, you do not get a charger with it. You will simply have a standard charger which will charge all phones. And therefore, instead of every new phone people buy coming with a big slab with an awful lot of copper in it, which all of those little transformer things are full of little coils of copper, that you could stop wasting all that copper. But that means that they don't want little adapters which are full of copper. They want it to be standard. And it's not stupid. I just hope they don't get their way until USB cops onto itself.
I disagree, Bart. I think it is stupid.
Okay, well, no, make the argument, because I'm certainly able to be convinced.
If this is for the betterment of consumers, number one, what happened to the free market? But if this is supposedly better for consumers, then why doesn't it include cameras? Why doesn't it include portable shavers? why doesn't it include my stereo system that runs off, you know, an internal battery? Why doesn't it include, I've got a small radio here that has rechargeable batteries in it.
Or there are laptops.
Millions of different devices, laptops that have rechargeable batteries. And with the modern portable lifestyle, there's only going to be more. What about those battery packs that you can buy? Do they have to have the same thing on them as well? They're only picking phones. It says to me that there's some, I mean, this is unusual for Europe, but there's some lobby group involved, or it's a distraction of some sort. I don't know what. It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Or
that this is only phones.
Or is it the finger in the door? Let's start with the biggest seller of these power blocks, which is phones, and then take it further from there.
What about batteries? Why can't we have a standard battery? You know, my iPhone has to take the same battery as an HTC, period, because that's for my convenience. Then we don't have to. Batteries are far more dangerous to the environment than power adapters. It's just nuts in my view. It's one little thing that's going to make a lot of manufacturers you know, are going to have extra work to do. But you know, I suppose they'll get past that. They'll make changes anyway. And it's great for the people of Europe. But if I travel to Europe with my anywhere else in the world iPhone, I'm screwed. I have to buy another adapter or borrow one or you know, do some sort of thing. I mean, I already have to do that. But at the moment, I can just take that little brick at the end, which has a USB plug on it, because Apple already do this, and I can use any USB charger today to charge my iPhone in any country of the world. What's wrong with that? Why do we have to change the connector on the phone end? I think it's just nuts.
It's probably, yeah. I certainly think that where they have it now, where Apple just have to give you an adapter so you can use USB, to me that makes sense. I actually think they're going too far now. But I do like the fact that we're going towards USB being a standard. So I guess I have. Yeah. Anyway,
but hopefully. Is it a standard or is it a product that has achieved ubiquity?
No, it's just USB. There's a whole group. Like USB isn't a company. USB is a whole big group together. So depending on how you define a standard, I'd say you can certainly make an argument USB is a standard.
It's a friend. It's there a friend go. Of mine.
It's a friend of yours. Very good.
Yeah. There you go. There's the title for the show.
Yeah, except we don't. I think the show's title is
Oh, that's right.
Four.
Sorry. Oh, that just rolls right off the tongue.
Well, actually, it'll be episode 4, December 2013. It really rolls off the tongue, but yeah. Anyway, having gone on for an hour and a half, I think we should probably wrap things up. Guys, thank you very much for putting in the time and for being flexible, especially Guy, for jumping in at the last minute. Very much appreciated.
Oh, no problem.
So now that we're ending the show, we can do proper plugging of everything. So, Guy, why don't you kick us off and tell people where they can listen to more of your lovely voice?
Well, more of my nonsense. It can be found on the MyMac.com podcast. You can find that in iTunes. On Twitter, you can find me at MacParrot or Guy and Gaz, which is kind of a combined Twitter account for the My Mac podcast. And let's see, I guess that's about it. Of course, I'm on Facebook and we have, the Google Plus community. It was mentioned earlier. Thank you for that. We have a My Mac podcast community, and it's a private community, so you do have to apply to jump in. And it's different. Let's just leave it at that.
I mean this as a compliment, Guy, but it's different can be said for many things you do.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. I couldn't argue with that either.
Anyway, thank you very much. Nick, where can people find you?
You can find me as Spligosh, that's Spligosh. No, I spelt it right this time. on Twitter. And I've actually applied for an About Me page, but I haven't actually done anything with it yet, so don't bother going there.
Okay. but next time you're on, maybe we will.
Well, yeah, but you never know.
And finally, the guy from tomorrow, Alistair, where can people find you?
Well, I do have an active about.me page, which is the best place to go, and that is about.me/ZKARJ. That's how it was defined. That's how I'll say it.
Okie dokie. All right, folks, thanks very much. I've been your host, Bart Bouchotz. You can find me at bartb.ie. If you'd like to find out more about the show, get in touch with the show. It's all over at let's-talk.ie. Until next time, happy computing.
Listening to another great podcast in the Stoplight Network.
On the MyMag.com podcast.
And how could they contact you, Gaz? For those who don't speak parrot, that's Gaz at MyMag.com, G-A-Z at MyMag.com, and you can also reach him on the Twitters at twitter.com/Gazmaz, G-A-Z, M-A-Z, and we have a combined Twitter account, which is twitter.com/ Guy and Gaz, G-U-I-A-N-D-G-A-Z. And if you wanted to let Fearless Leader know that you don't speak parrot, you can let him know that by sending an email to feedback@mymac.com, no Z.
You're listening to the G-Men